Hey, everyone, and welcome to But That's Just My Opinion, the podcast hosted by me, Matt Lantrip.
And me, David Navarro.
So, everyone, as you may have noticed right there, that's a little different.
Yeah.
Not I'm doing new. My full tagline there. And I am trying something new. I am adding a co-host.
I'm a co-host now.
Yes,
this
David.
I went from being the first guest to being the first second guest to being the first co-host.
Yeah, pretty much.
I'm a series of firsts, and it is exciting, and I'm almost like a cameo. I'm not like all like a cameo.
Also,
a cameo
you have the best schedule to line up with me during the week.
Oh, so it's not about my skill as a co-host.
No, it's the fact that no,
my resume.
It's multiple things.
Okay,
I don't know you as a co-host. I'm just going to throw this out there. You're my mom's least favorite guest.
Really?
Yeah, because you talk over me, and she just wants to hear me.
Oh. Matt's mother, I'm so incredibly sorry.
It's only because she loves me more than you, and she just wants to hear me more, and that's pretty much the only gripe.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it's fair, right?
I'm sure my mother would feel exactly the same way. That being said, your mother is a lovely woman, and I'm sorry that I've robbed her of listening to her son speak clearly and in a good cadence.
So you're going
to
be like the Morning Zoo sidekick, where you come in every once in a while with a fart and a burp and go, yep.
Yeah, maybe. I'll have to get a soundboard for I think most of that. The belching and coffee drinking is probably going to be more frequent than anything else.
Yeah, a lot more drinking on this podcast now, not in the form of actual alcohol, but in the form of hearing someone actually drink, because that'll be David, because he likes to drink and talk at the same time.
I do. I also like to eat and talk at the same time.
Yeah, which is not going to happen. There's only one episode I am saving eating on the podcast for, and I'm still trying to work it out to get it happen.
What's the plan?
Me and Tim are going to hook ourselves up with lavs and cook and talk at the same time.
Okay. Nice. Tim's a great cook.
Yeah.
That'll be awesome.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I mean, he works like 6 days a week, so it's kind of hard to get him over here.
Right. I mean, thank God we don't have a third person here, because we would just...
It wouldn't work.
You know, it'd be awful.
Yeah. Luckily, with two people, I can just beat David over the head.
Yeah, exactly.
Every
we'll just unplug my mic. We'll unplug me, and then you'll just like hear me yelling.
But I got something to say!
It'll be perfect. Just lock me in the bathroom and make me think about my actions.
Yeah, pretty much. Like a small child. All right, so as you can see, there will be a lot of nonsense, and we will definitely... I mean, if you've listened to any of the two that David was on, we try to stay on point as much as possible, but this is... So the plan from here on out is that me and David will be doing the episodes together. Every once in a while, we may interview someone because the other can't be there. We will have people on as a third person. We're just kind of going to do what we can. But for the most part, we're going to try to keep it. Not try to keep it. We would like to have as many guests as we can on. But David is here to help me out, especially when I get busy or he gets busy. We can bring someone in, and also, so this way it comes out. We make sure something comes out every week if it's the two of us, because there will always be something to put out.
Getting the extra content push.
I really appreciate it, David, that you are willing to do this with me. I know we always have fun conversations.
I'm honored.
All we like to do is just talk and take jabs at each other.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the third time we're bringing it up, and the third episode that I'm on is that we disagree more than we agree, and I think we really enjoy disagreeing with each other.
Yeah, because me and you are like the only two people that I would say, like, because most of the people we know agree with us one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
But me and you are really like the two friends that like disagree the most, but also have the most points to back up their own argument.
I'll say that's fair. I think Will, for instance, is someone that I really respect in his ability to argue.
Well, that's what he went to school for.
He did go to school, like, basically to study arguing, more or less.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, absolutely. I think what it comes down to is we just enjoy the other person's argument enough to not think they're an idiot.
And what I'm trying to say is, like, me and you, out of anyone, most people I have conversations with in which I disagree with them.
Mm-hmm.
You bring the most actual facts and points to the table.
I don't know about facts.
Maybe not. Well, granted, yes, a lot of what we talk about is opinion.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Hence,
I mean,
my opinion. But you actually bring up anecdotal stuff and like different things to actually show why that's your opinion. You show how it directly affects, and you can cross-compare it to different things when other people are just like, it's just stupid. It shouldn't have been like that.
Right.
Here's what I would have done. It's not a matter of what you would have done. you being like, me and you oftentimes are like, well, look how they did it here, and look how they did it there, and look at this and that, and we can bring it like...
Cross compare.
Exactly. It's like we can show the precedent already set.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that's my favorite thing about arguing, is bringing up other points. That's why I like video essays so much. Yeah. To that point, talking about how they should have done things, let's talk about split.
Okay, yeah. So today we're going to... I think we are going to try to have themes for each one. Mm-hmm. And I think today we're going to talk about split, and I think that's going to dive us into sequels.
It's going to dive us into a few things, I think. Yeah. First and foremost, I don't think I actually got your take on how you felt about Split. How do you feel about the movie?
I really enjoyed it.
Okay.
I am a fan of M. Night Shyamalan, of everything before Lady in the Water.
Lady in the Water is a masterpiece, and you should go back and watch it again.
I probably should. I just didn't enjoy the first time.
I'm totally kidding. I've only seen it the once, and it didn't turn me on in any way. Yeah. It's Shyamalan. Look at your spelling.
Shyamalan Ding Dong.
Yeah, Shyamalan Ding Dong.
Shyamalan Ding Dong.
M. Night Shyamalan. He actually... I'm really polarized with him because... Yeah, he's done like four movies that are like really, really freaking good.
Yeah, his first four, which was... Yeah, I was going to say like...
Yeah.
Sixth Sense, Unbreakable, Signs, and The Village. I thought like for a first four for a director, you're like, holy crap.
Yeah, I mean like he very quickly established himself as an adequate storyteller and as someone who understands visual storytelling specifically.
And he had his own style already, and like all the movies felt the same. You could tell, yeah, this is an M. Night Shyamalan movie.
Exactly,
he is telling a certain type of story. He is pretty much already set, like he has set himself differently and already got into a rhythm.
I would even add in Devil into that group of movies that I enjoy by M. Night Shyamalan.
He didn't direct it. He just produced it.
I'm pretty sure he directed. Let's bring it up on the Googles at some point, but I'm pretty sure...
I'll look it up right now. He did not direct Devil, but Devil was great.
It is, but I believe it is considered an M. Night Shyamalan movie.
Probably because he produced it. He might have had some overseeing into it, but I don't think he had the final say like he did on most.
Well, I think what I'm getting at least in this sense, is that... When I think of Devil, I think of it as an M. Night Shyamalan movie, which I think says something about him and the movie.
So, directed by John Eric Dowdle.
Wow.
Screenplay by Brian Nelson and M. Night.
Yeah, he didn't... Well, he co-wrote it.
He came up with the story.
Okay.
It says screenplay by Brian Nelson and then story by M. Night Shyamalan.
Shyamalan. There you go.
Shyamalan Ding Dong.
He has a certain style. He has a handful of themes that he likes to draw from the well of. And he used Derek Mears in, I think, the funniest way possible. Derek Mears, the actor who plays Jason.
In Devil?
No, he's in Alien. He's in Signs. He's the alien standing on the roof.
I can't remember.
Yeah, okay, so there's the shot... where Mel Gibson is like, I don't even know if Mel Gibson sees it, but like, it's the alien standing on the barn. It's a pretty iconic shot.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That alien is played by Derek Mears.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Who is Jason.
Oh, Jason Voorhees?
Yeah, Jason. So Jason is...
Oh, got it,
Jason is the alien standing on the barn house.
Okay. Now, you have to throw Jason Voorhees in the back of that. Otherwise, I didn't know you were making a Friday the 13th.
If I say the name Jason in itself and I'm talking about movies, I think it's...
Yeah, I figured that was implied. A character name in one of his movies. Because all his characters have pretty standard names.
They do. Their actors don't.
No, but all his characters are... I think it's to make up for the fact that he has a really weird name.
Yeah, I guess it kind of makes sense. It's like whatchamacallit. He's self-conscious about the weirdness of his name. But what's his first name? I don't even know.
M.
M. Knight.
Him and M. Ward just hang out.
But yeah, so in reference to those four movies in Split, I think Split, it harkens back to his earlier films. It's not The Happening. It's not Lady in the Water.
It's not The Last Airbender.
It's not The Last Airbender. After Earth is really surprising as one of his movies.
Well, they when they were promoting that, they said, do not say it's an M. Night Shyamalan movie.
Yeah, because it just turns everyone off.
Yeah.
See, and that leads me to my first point.
Which I think After Earth was decent enough that people were like, okay, we can throw it back. But let me finish what I actually thought of the movie before we dive into points. Yeah, because I didn't get to do that.
You're right. Yeah. You said that you liked
it. You know, my mom was totally right.
I'm a mic hog. That's the problem.
I know. But this is why you're the co-host and I'm the host.
I'll be quieter.
No, I'm just joking with you. Yeah, so, I mean, I really enjoyed it. I thought, it was a small enough story. You know, there wasn't, in terms of plot, there was definitely enough plot.
Yeah.
But his movie has always been character-driven more than plot-driven,
mm-hmm.
and he got back to that. I think that's where he started getting in trouble.
Was trying to do too much plot, and not enough character. Yeah, exactly. I mean, because The Happening is very little of Mark Wahlberg.
I did not expect that.
Thank you. I was just
Transformer.
I was just trying to say Mark Wahlberg. But Wahlberg came out awful. Mark came out the way I wanted.
You sounded like the little
out.
Kid in the movie.
Yeah, et cetera. Yeah, and then you look back at stuff like Signs. Like, Signs is really a movie about a man dealing with his crisis of faith.
Yeah.
And the whole movie is, I mean, like, when you look at, like, just the climax of that movie, takes a pause to have that emotional climax where we go and we watch the death of his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And, like,
which also happens in Split.
Yeah. I mean, like, there's a visual climax where, like, the monster is coming to the doors,
yeah.
and, like, they're trapped in the basement. And then just at the height of, like, the thrill, you know, your palms are sweaty, knees weak, arms are heavy. And then instead of mom spaghettiing it, it walks away from the climax for a moment, because that's not what the movie's about. The movie's not about the aliens in the house. The movie's about Mel Gibson and his crisis of faith.
Yeah.
And so when we go back to set that scene, it's like, it really solidifies the movie as a character drama that's taking place in a monster movie.
And yeah, to that point, the flashback in this is you seeing the main character being abused and molested. Well, not you don't see it, but it is,
yeah, it's heavily implied.
It gives you everything besides that actual scene to
right.
show you that she is
scarred and
damaged. She's living with her uncle after her father dies, and there was a point where she could have shot her uncle,
yeah, and could have been rid of her literal demon.
And it shows the redemption, and it sets up everything. You know,
yeah,
like,
and
how she knows how to use a shotgun,
and that's,
like,
especially there's a perfect moment, like, once she picks up the shotgun. Well, okay, so let's get into, before we get there, because there's something very specific I want to talk about in her picking up the shotgun.
Okay,
and I think it's M. Night Shyamalan, and the way that you were talking about how when After Earth was coming out, they could not market it as a Shyamalan movie. I think this had to be marketed specifically as an M. Night Shyamalan.
Totally.
And I think specifically for a handful of reasons. Spoiler alert. Can we spoil?
Yeah.
Okay, so spoiling...
We already talked about the...
Yeah, well, sort of.
her past.
So spoiling it... I'm spoiling the last 10 seconds.
Oh, like the very, very last?
The very, very last thing.
Okay.
Okay, so spoiling the last 10 seconds of the movie, if you are not a huge fan of M. Night Shyamalan, don't worry about it. If you do like a lot of M. Night Shyamalan, worry about it. Go see the movie first. Yeah,
he gives a callback to what I think is his best movie.
Yeah, so it's an Unbreakable, not necessarily sequel. It is a follow-up to Unbreakable.
It solidifies that it's in the same universe.
Yeah, it's in the same universe. It's a tie-in. And I think that outside of that, really, I mean, if that never even happened, you have to market this as a Night Shyamalan movie for a handful of reasons.
Yeah.
And I think because there is no actual twist in this movie. And I think that is so important.
There is kind of a twist.
I think the twist actually is the Unbreakable reveal.
I don't think that's the twist. I think the twist is the fact that what the doctor was saying, like, so in the main antagonist, the villain, he has DID. I can't remember.
Kevin is his name, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. So
but
Kevin,
his main.
Right.
He has 23 personalities.
Right. And what's the female's name? There's Dennis and one other chick.
But Miss Patricia.
Miss Patricia, yeah.
And what's Hedwig?
Hedwig
is
the small
kid.
Yeah, so Miss Patricia,
Barry,
and Dennis.
And then Barry's the guy that he mainly shows up to the therapist.
Right.
So this guy has, he had trauma. You find out mm-hmm. he had trauma as a little kid. His mom used to physically, mentally abuse him. So to deal with it, he created different identities. And pretty much became schizophrenic and, like, now has 23 different identities. And they believe that a 24th identity, two of the identities are evil,
mm-hmm.
and believe that there is a 24th identity coming called the Beast.
Right.
That is going to...
Do you think the twist is that the Beast is real?
Yes.
I think you're wrong. Primarily...
Not so much that the Beast is real, but I think the twist is... So, Yeah, let me. Mm-hmm. So along the way, we find out that the psychiatrist that he's seeing actually is doing research to show that these personal identities can change physiological features. Mm-hmm. So like one character, one of his identities has diabetes, but anytime he's in the other 22, no trace of diabetes whatsoever. There right. are times where it's like certain identities have high cholesterol and none of the other ones do. It's like, so the fact is the identities can actually change your body
right.
so much. And so the fact is not so much that the beast is fake. I mean, that the beast is real, that identity is real, but the fact that he is actually able
to transform his
body into an unbreakable type of thing.
Yeah, into this monster, essentially.
Yeah, he pretty much is able to like unlock brain potential to become an actual beast.
Here's why I don't think that's a twist, and I'm going to compare it immediately to The Sixth Sense. I think The Sixth Sense is the perfect M. Night Shyamalan movie. The thing about the twist in that movie is if we watch that movie with an understanding of the ending, it's a new movie, right?
Yeah.
Rewatching that movie, we're watching how Bruce Willis is dead the whole time.
Yeah.
And likewise, like the entire time we're watching it the first time, we're being shown clues, but we don't know what they mean yet.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the case of Split, the beast is referred to so often and explained. I mean, it takes multiple scenes for them to set up the idea that he can transform his biology via his different identities, that it becomes sort of a Chekhov's gun, that like the beast is in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You promise a beast, you talk about the beast. The climax is not going to be him thinking he is a beast when he's really not. Like, the climax of this movie logically is going to be, there's going to be some sort of monster on screen. Whether that's going to be something that transforms physically and has like long hair the way it's described and has crazy fingernails and like becomes like this wolf man, maybe not. That's what I was looking forward
to. But we knew that based off him going right. back and forth.
The movie telegraphs to us that there's going to be a climax involving a bestial version of Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that's a twist. I don't think it can be the twist because we're not being, it's not like there's subtle clues being left behind. Like if we had just had Hedwig drawings, right? And Hedwig's drawings are the only time we ever saw the beast.
And so Hedwig is one of the personalities right. in Kevin's head, and which is a 9-year-old boy.
Yeah, he's a 9-year-old boy and he draws a bunch of things. And later on in the movie, so he draws things that first off he's seen before. Right, so like, I don't know if you've realized this, but when we see his room, he has a lot of drawings of animals, and then later we discover that he lives in the zoo. So it's possible that he's drawing things that he sees. Then he also has a handful of drawings of the beast, like depictions of like a monster. So everything he's drawn is real. He doesn't draw fiction in that setup. And so like now that we see the drawings of the beast, that has to be real as well. So like
that makes sense.
If that had been the only mention of the beast outside of Kevin's talking about it, had been the drawings about the beast.
Yeah.
I think the twist being the beast would make sense. But because there are multiple scenes with the psychiatrist, where there are multiple scenes of him talking about it, where like there's all this setup, I think that's not the twist.
I mean, I get it. I mean, yeah, obviously the beast has to be there, otherwise it's anticlimactic. To me, it was just the actual, I understood like the physiological changes, but to me it was the actual physiological mm-hmm. change of making yourself like essentially a human body armor.
Right, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's crazy, but I don't think it's necessarily a Shyamalan twist. And that's, I think, the great thing that Shyamalan did is that's kind of a huge red herring, right? You walk into that movie, and every single person in that movie is sitting there in their little comfortable movie seat thinking, all right, I can outsmart M. Night Shyamalan. I've seen all of his movies. I know what a twist looks like. I will pick it out. I'm going to catch that Bruce Willis is dead this time. And you don't, right? Because you're sitting there, and you're trying to figure it out, and it's like, oh, you know what? There's going to be a monster. Red herring. He's just trying to throw you off, man. He's just trying to put something out there and be like, all right, the moviegoers are going to be like, they're going to think this is a twist. They're going to be fixated on it. They're not going to notice all this other stuff I'm setting up. So we're like, okay, cool. So then you watch this. There's also this extra sequence where, like, right in the beginning, our protagonist, I'm doing it in quotations, our teenager who seems to be a little more savvy about the situation, she has a bunch of scenes where we're setting up that she is equipped to deal with abuse, right?
Yeah.
In the very first sequence, it's, you know, she tells the other girl to pee on herself before she thinks she's about to get raped. She's like, just pee on yourself. And the girls are freaking out, and she's very calmly, pee on yourself. Just do it.
Because it will turn them off. And
exactly. Like, and it works, you know? And so all of a sudden we're given this huge clue, like, she can handle this situation.
Yeah, you can already tell, okay, she has some past.
Exactly.
You don't know what it is, but you know she knows what she's doing enough that she's been through something similar to this.
Yeah, and so in my mind, I'm immediately thinking, okay, the twist has to do with her and her relationship to this scenario. Is she somehow related to this guy? Does she know this guy? Because there's also that very distinct moment where he gets into the car to knock out the two girls, mm-hmm. and he doesn't knock her out. And then she's about to leave the car, and he doesn't react until the door is open.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, now that we've seen the whole movie, we know that's just because he wasn't planning on her being there, so he didn't even think of her being there. He just mm-hmm. missed her.
Mm-hmm.
But in watching that movie the first go, we see very clearly that he does not care that she's sitting there. And so we're thinking, okay, there's something being communicated between these two. He is saying something by not knocking her out. He's also made the conscious decision to not do it. It's like we start feeling, you know, I started feeding all these corkboard conspiracy theorist ideas that she is related to him somehow. She's like the little sister. She has been kidnapped by him before. She is the reason that the other girls were kidnapped is because she was in the car. Some of that effect. I'm trying to figure out how this all comes together.
Absolutely none of that is true.
No, none of that happens. And I think that's the second red herring. I think I was given that as like, I'm the type of movie viewer who's going to see that red herring and bite on it and stick with it.
See, to me, that was never, I never thought that. What I thought was like, oh, she was just calm enough that the only reason he did to the other girls is because they started like
right,
talking back.
Freaked out.
Yeah. And so her just sitting there, he was like, it was more like, okay, you're just going to be comatose, you know. And
right. You're already terrified.
Yeah. Until you do something to make me have to do this, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah. I mean, that's how you read it. That's different from how I read it. That's just my opinion, man. But what I'm getting at is like, there's all these red herrings throughout the movie that knowing it's an M. Night Shyamalan film, we latch onto. Like, you latched on to the idea of the beast transforming his biology. I latched on to the idea of her being somehow connected to him. And neither of those end up being the twist. I think the actual twist and what makes you go back and rewatch this movie as a different type of movie is the fact that we don't understand that this is not a horror thriller, but this movie is actually a villain's origin story.
I guess that's true.
Right, because in the last 10 seconds, we get the Mr. Glass connection. Bruce Willis is his character from Unbreakable.
Yeah, done.
Yeah, we're in the same universe. So now we realize that there's going to be another movie where Bruce Willis has to go fight this thing in the street. Like, Bruce Willis is going to go toe-to-toe with the beast.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only logical conclusion we can draw.
Yeah. Which I don't think they should do.
I don't know. Like, I'm going to leave that up for him to decide, I think. Shyamalan, if that's what he wants to do, that's what he wants to do. I'll go see that movie because I'll be interested in seeing what happens.
Me too. I
think it would be hard to do. I think it would be hard to do an hour and a half and fill it with them fighting. I mean, maybe if it's Bruce Willis, like, hunting him down and make it like a real adventure of, like, he is hunting through, like, the woods being, like, this city.
Yeah.
And, like, he's hunting down the beast to, like, kill it. That would be one thing. To, like, have them, like, toe up in the middle of the street would be another thing that I think would be kind of weak. Have, like, a Matrix showdown.
Well, to me, that's not Shyamalan's strength. Shyamalan is not about action. He's not about that type of stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, because even the action, so-called action thing in this isn't really action heavy. It's just, like, a slow crawl towards you.
Right.
And so to have a face-off of a beast who has managed to make himself impenetrable versus a guy who literally his only weakness is drowning.
Right. I think Bruce Willis wins that fight.
Oh, of course.
10 out of 10. He's Superman.
Yeah, he's essentially Superman, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it would be rough to do, and I think that you have to handle that situation very carefully. Otherwise, viewers like us go in and be like, ah, what a letdown.
Yeah, see, to me, I just don't think that's Shyamalan's forte, his strength at all. I think just ending it and giving that in your mind, because in the end, the girl has to go. You find out the girl has to go back with her uncle. So because you see right. her as like maybe 10 years younger when she first goes and like has to live with her uncle after, you know, she's already been, mm-hmm. you know, being mistreated by him. And then, you know, but then at the end, you can see like now she finally has the strength to stand up to him.
Right. In fact, but I thought that was going to be the twist moment was because very specifically the police officer who comes to her while she's sitting in the back of the car and she's alerting her that her uncle's there. She doesn't use the word uncle.
At first she says guardian is here.
Yeah, she says your guardian is here.
You hear in the background someone is talking to the officer. They're not talking to her. They say, "Hey, Casey Cook's guardian is here. Go grab her." And then the officer walks over and goes, "Hey, your uncle's here."
No. She says guardian.
No. The guardian is not specifically to Casey. No.
Yeah, it is. She says your guardian's here. The police officer says your guardian's here. Because the moment that happens, I was thinking, in the background, we should see Dennis walk out and stand in the little negative space between the door and the police officer. And then, we'll have a moment where, Dennis is standing there, and Dennis has decided that he's going to come back and get her.
Yeah.
And then my thought, the second she said guardian, this whole sequence played out where Dennis walks out. We see Dennis. We cut back to her. She's terrified for a moment. She opens the door, gets out of the car. That was the twist in my head. Didn't happen. She goes back with the uncle, we presume. So, even in that moment, the movie's over now, right? She is the master of two worlds, more or less. She's going home. The story's over. And then we cut to the diner scene. And that's when we get our twist. And the twist has to be that this is not just an unbreakable tie-in, but that this is actually a villain's origin story.
Yeah.
This is Frankenstein being created. This is Dracula being bitten. Wolfman getting, turning into the wolf. This is Loki getting wronged by Thor. This is a villain's origin story.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think changes the way you watch a movie. I don't know yet. I have to go back and watch it. But I would presume that if I were to go sit down in this movie, I would start looking at it as a, who cares about the teenage girls? They are irrelevant to the story. What I'm watching is this man battling himself, right? Watching Barry battle Hedwig, battle Dennis, battle, Trisha. Watching these characters within this person do battle with each other.
Yeah.
And that's what I think the twist is. And I think M. Night Shyamalan very, very geniusly made essentially a meta twist. Because instead of having a twist where it's, they're in modern times and she was blind so she can go see the real world because she'll never be able to communicate it. Or Bruce Willis is dead the whole time. Or the alien's weakness is water. Instead of having one of these twists, or it's plants. Plant life is killing people. Instead of having one of these twists where we change a viewing of the movie visually, we're now we're looking for clues as to how does the world react to Bruce Willis? Does anyone ever look at him? No. Very specifically crafted to where Bruce Willis never has an effect on the real world in that movie.
Yeah.
I think instead of doing something like that, what M. Night Shyamalan did was he made a meta twist. He twisted the genre of the movie, which changed, I think, the content of the movie within it. It's like if we were to sit here in Pacific Rim. Let's not look at Pacific Rim as an action film. Let's look at it as a romance film. And now the content of that movie is different.
Mm.
Right? Because honestly, what Pacific Rim is trying to do is tell a love story.
Yeah. I think it's way more of an action film.
Yeah. Effectively, what we ended up seeing was this over-the-top robot-fighting monster action film.
And it was awesome.
But at its core, the story that we're being told is it's a love story. It's a story...
I would say that's more for Crimson Peak.
I haven't seen Crimson Peak.
Okay. I have it if you want to watch it.
Yeah, let me borrow it. But what I'm getting at is movies have the story that's being told within them somewhere. We just have to find the story.
Mm-hmm.
Whatchamacallit? Signs being a story about Mel Gibson and his crisis of faith.
Yeah.
That's what that movie's about. And it happens to be during a time where aliens are attacking the farmyard or the farmhouse. Mm-hmm. But that's not what the movie's about. The movie's not about the aliens. The movie's about the internal struggle.
It's like Jaws. Jaws isn't about a shark attacking an ocean.
Yeah, Jaws is about a family.
And a man overcoming his fear of the water.
Exactly. It's very specifically about one character and his specific journey through the world.
Yeah.
Jaws is only in... two shots? I think one shot?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, Jaws is not in the movie.
No.
He's not... The monster is a representation of something else, right? It's a symbology that we're looking at to watch this character overcome his internal struggle. So yeah, I think in the case of Split, I think what we're watching is an internal struggle that is so literally an internal struggle because it's five or six characters fighting internally
inside a person's brain.
which I think when we stop watching that as a monster and start watching him as a villain, it changes the movie entirely. We stop looking at the girls as the protagonists. We start looking at I'd almost hazard to say that Hedwig can't be the protagonist. Dennis might be the protagonist. I mean, I think Kevin is something within Kevin is the protagonist. Kevin is the hero of the story.
Kinda.
I think he has to be. I don't know.
I think you're reading way too much into it, personally.
Well, I think if we were to sit down and rewatch it and watch it through the lens of this is a villain's origin story, we would see that she's not the protagonist. I think if we watch it through that lens, we would figure that out. And yeah, I'm reading way too much into it. I mean, this is me pulling apart a movie that is about DID and a girl trying to escape this monster.
Yeah, I still think Casey is the protagonist because, I mean, it mainly does focus on her trying to outsmart him.
Right, but there's all these sequences where she's not even relevant to the story that's being told. There's all these sequences where it's him dealing with his therapist.
I get you, but you can have an antagonist that's still the main character.
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
that's where I think I'm getting kind of lost with you, because I don't think you have to call him the protagonist. To me, the protagonist is the main good guy and the antagonist is the main bad guy. You can have an antagonist who is still the main character. It's just he's also the villain.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. But so I also me, think calling, he's the hero as well.
I don't think so. I don't think so at all.
Because I think we're watching a villain movie. I think we're watching a movie about a villain becoming a villain.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean he's still a hero. It doesn't mean
he's the hero of his journey, though. He has to go on his journey to become what he like. He has become the master of two worlds, right? He has to go.
It's like a flipped on its head hero's journey.
Yeah, it's a villain's hero journey.
Okay, in that sense, yes. Right? But the way you were presenting it was, no, he's also the good guy somehow.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess that is a poor way of putting it. But yeah, what I'm getting at is if we watch that movie, he's the main character of the movie.
Because if you want to say the real good guy is Kevin when he finally snaps out of it.
Exactly.
For a
like, yeah.
But that's different because each personality is essentially its own character.
Right.
So there's a difference. So there is a huge difference between Dennis and Kevin.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're different characters. It's the same difference between Han and Luke.
Yeah.
Exactly. It was just, they just happen to coincide in the same body and they can't be on screen at the same time.
Exactly. Well, they can.
Sort of.
We watched it. I got to say, James McAvoy. Fantastic.
Yeah, you know, and here's the thing is I think it's really easy, and I literally have not heard one person make this criticism, but I've offered this as possible criticism every single time I've had this conversation. I think it would be really easy to sit here and be like, yeah, James McAvoy was handed a role where he played 23 different people, 24 different people, 25 different people, right? He played all these different characters, so yeah, he had to show character range. He had to show the ability to act, you know, whatever. Like, it's really easy to make that argument, but even still, like, I think in that argument he is an adequate actor who handled his job correctly, but I think honestly that would be taking something away from him because he did a good job.
And he did to like, me
it was he wasn't the sum or he was more than the sum of his parts.
Exactly. And to me it wasn't so much that, like, yeah, it's real easy to go between the characters when they're cutting.
Oh, yeah.
With the editing, like from an editing and filmmaking standpoint, it's super easy to get that done.
Yeah, you just film one actor playing five different characters.
Yeah, and you can do it from different times. So every time he switches, it's cutting back and forth so he can stop. He can get into that character and do it. What really impressed me was the scenes where it was like just one shot and you watched him go through three different personalities without a single cut.
Yeah, I mean, those things are interesting.
Those are the scenes I'm talking about when I say, like, give him props. Because, like, yeah, I mean, we could sit here, I could put a camera on you, and if I gave you 5 minutes in between each take to do someone new, you could get it.
Right. I think, but also, to his credit, he makes every single character seem real, and he does a good job in each character.
There is so much variation between every single one within body language, with how they speak.
And again, as an actor, he should be able to shoot five different roles because he's not. Yeah. But even still, I think he elevates each one of those roles. And that's the most impressive thing is the fact that he takes each one of those roles and he brings it to a level that I think only James McAvoy would have been capable of doing.
Yeah.
Or in such a way that only James McAvoy could have done.
Yeah. And it's those mannerisms for me, like, when you see him going back and forth between Hedwig and Dennis and Barry, all within the same shot. So there's literally no cutting, and you kind of see him freaking out. But literally how, like, he'll start talking one way and his body within 1 second will be in a completely different posture. The way it's just the way he's looking and presenting himself. All completely different.
It was very cool. I give him a lot of props for that. I think most importantly for me with James McAvoy is he seemed, I mean, there were times where he stopped being James McAvoy and like he was a 9-year-old boy.
Oh, totally.
And effectively I'm sitting there and I'm like, okay, this is a 9-year-old boy and I completely believe it. I'm not like looking at someone pretending to be a little 9-year-old boy. Like I completely, yeah. I mean, and then even he acted as Dennis pretending to be Barry. And even that, like, there's something really interesting in that. I mean, we didn't see in a lot of Barry as himself.
Except for that, like, yeah, that clip on the computer.
But even still, like, you can see Dennis's mannerisms, not just in, like, the focused ones, like, where they make us see him, like, being OCD throughout the room. Like, they force us to see that when they telegraph it to us. But, like, even, like, the when four smiles, the conversation he has with the doctor, mm-hmm. like, you can see Dennis there.
Yeah. What I really liked is, like, when Barry's first coming in, he's like walking, you know, he's walking up and he's still kind of got like that jaunty walk like Barry would have.
Right.
But he still has the rag. He opens the door as Barry with his handkerchief and then puts it back in his pocket.
Right.
Which is a thing only Dennis does.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of small things in there. That it's a solid film. Like when I sat there and I wrote my review on it, I think without the Unbreakable twist, it's an okay movie in which James McAvoy did some cool stuff.
I think it doesn't need the Unbreakable twist.
I don't think it's as good without it. I think it's an okay movie. Because like going into the final sequence, there's that moment where she's holding the shotgun. And I thought that was a brilliant move of her holding the shotgun. And Master Two World, she can overcome her fear. She can take the shot that she couldn't take years ago. I think that was a really good move, and I thought that was a great storytelling piece, but I don't think I cared enough about her. Like, I cared just enough to, like, understand that the plot was centered around her. And, like,
they gave her enough sympathy so that when she overcame it, you're like, okay, you're a stronger person now.
Exactly. Like, it's all shown to us, and we're walked through it, so we understand her journey, and that's cool, but, like, there's no part of me that was sitting there like, yeah, she deserves to live, like, or, like, I want her to live. Like, oh, my God, this guy might kill her. At that point in the movie, I was like, well, either one of them can live at this point, and I'm not going to care. Like, one of them is going to die, one of them is going to live, or they're both going to die. Like, something's going to happen now, and I'm not entirely sure that it's going to make this movie or break it. Like, it's going to happen.
I don't think their life or death was too heavy of a consequence, because by that point, it was organically made not to be, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Because it didn't matter what happened at that point. Shyamalan could have done a ton of things.
I think what he did was great.
Yeah, what he did was probably perfect, leaving them both alive and having emotional conclusions for both of them. I think it was a strong move. And at that moment, I was thinking, okay, M. Night Shyamalan did two things really well. He had the balls not to kill the monster, which, sure, like, a lot of movies don't kill the monster, because they have like that last sequence where like the hand breaks out of the snow or whatever. But like not having a moment where the hero slays the dragon is, I think, important emotionally. In the same way that I think more stories need to start killing heroes. Heroes don't get the protagonist shield if it makes no sense. You know what I mean?
I get you. Yeah, I get you. Like if a hero should die,
then a hero should die. Like just because you complete the hero's journey doesn't mean you get to go home.
They get to go to the hospital and make it in time and live, but now they exactly. got to live, whatever.
It's, like, have you seen Passengers yet?
No.
Do you mind if I spoil it for you?
Kinda.
Okay. It's real bad.
I've heard it's good.
You've heard it's good from who?
Just reading reviews and different things.
You've read reviews by assholes. It's a bad movie. And yet the worst part is there's 6 good movies in that movie. They didn't make any of them.
we'll have to talk about it.
Yeah. That, talk about Split. Like, like that movie is different personalities.
Gotcha. I did read all the reviews where all like the stupid social justice warriors were like, oh my God, look, he's such a, this movie is just glorifying male chauvinism.
Oh,
and it's like, really? Because everything I've seen is like, no, he comes off as a creep and he gets his comeuppance. I don't see why that's a bad thing.
Yeah,
we'll talk about
go watch the movie.
Yeah,
go watch the movie. We'll have another whole talk about this, because I have 6 different movies I could pitch to you that are better than that movie that take the same premise.
Got it.
I have 6, Okay. And I think they're all better. Speaking of which, I have a movie I want to pitch you.
Okay, well, hold on. We're not. I want to wrap up Split in a nice little monstrous and nice little bow.
And yeah. a little monstrous bow.
So personally, I don't think. I mean, what I thought was cool. So, and there's a lot of stuff that isn't even paid off till like the last 2 minutes of the movie. Like, you know, how the Beast, you know, how he knows all to do all these things. Turns out he works in a zoo, and the Beast is essentially an amalgamation of all the best characteristics of all the animals at the zoo.
Right.
So, like, that's really interesting. At the end, it's like, the whole time you're also wondering where he lives and what tunnel system he's at, where he has a locker for work.
Right.
And stuff, and it turns out, oh, yeah, and then, like, she even ends up in a cage. Mm-hmm. You're like, huh, I wonder how that happened. Oh, yeah, like, everything, that's one thing that's really done well. There's nothing that's really left. Everything everything served a purpose.
Yeah, and that movie ties itself into a bow.
Yeah, everything serves a purpose.
Except for one sequence.
Which one?
The Jeopardy sequence.
What was the Jeopardy
sequence? When the, right after, we're with the, the therapist. And the therapist like says goodbye to one of her patients.
Oh, yeah,
like,
some blonde I know what girl. You're talking about.
And then her neighbor like, psst, come over here.
Yeah.
And like they have a conversation about like, do you believe them? Of course I believe them. But we already knew that she believed them. It was a weird scene that like had no purpose. And like she sat down and they watched Jeopardy for a moment.
Yeah.
And then like, yeah, I mean, I turned to my friends who I was with and I was like, what the fuck was that? And they were like, I have no idea. Like what?
To me, in my head, what that came down to was, remember how there at one point she's like, I gave up my traditional life of family and kids and all that to be with you guys because you guys are, you know, my patients are my family.
Uh-huh.
To me, that was, okay, so she is, like, that old lady, her neighbor, is pretty much going to have to be the one to identify her at the end. Because at the end, you hear one of the cops in the background saying, we're still looking for family members to come ID the psychiatrist.
Yeah, I mean,
to me, that was just kind of like a...
But just leave it. I mean, the way I took that scene was that sequence is to make us to have that conversation. So we understand her view that, no, she believes every single one of them. But we already know that. So I don't think that scene serves a purpose. Otherwise, what is that scene? Because, yeah, I mean, we don't need to have the body. Like, we could have a sequence at the end where she's dead. And then a cop says, we're still waiting on family to ID the body. And let that just lay.
Yeah, I guess so.
She's like, oh, yeah, that's right. She doesn't have family.
Yeah, I guess that's the only scene you probably have to take out.
Yeah, and it's kind of a waste. But other than that, like, fine movie. I'm looking forward to hearing about Unbreakable 2. I think Unbreakable is a phenomenal film, and I'm glad that they're doing something with it.
I don't want that. I don't want Unbreakable 2. Because here's the thing. I think what he did was great. He left the rest of it open to imagination. So you don't actually see her uncle picking her up, but you know it's him. You see Bruce Willis's character from Unbreakable, and you're like, okay, now he's gonna have to go stop him. And you don't even afterwards, when the Beast gets away, you don't see the Beast again. The last people we're left with are Hedwig and Dennis.
Right.
So it's like, okay, we know these are taking over, and he's gonna be out there. Somehow someone's gonna have to stop him. That's where Bruce Willis's thing comes in. And then, you know, she's gonna go back. Everything didn't have to be wrapped up on screen, but it was wrapped up enough that you can draw your own conclusions.
I think you make a perfect point.
And I think that's what I really liked about the ending.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've made that incredibly cogent and a perfect argument. I agree entirely with you now. That being said, I still love Unbreakable.
Oh, it's hands down my favorite M. Night Shyamalan movie.
And I'm okay. And yeah, it's such a weird movie that like
it's so
that
good.
no one knows about.
No, like,
we finished watching in a pretty crowded theater, and like it was me, my roommates Matt, Caleb, and then our friend Eddie from Boston, and the four of us freaked out. We're all looking at each other like, oh my god, can you believe? Like,
I know.
Like we're having a panic attack, and everyone else in the theater is dead silent, and like the movie hasn't ended yet. We just saw Bruce Willis, and we're freaking out, and then like, we're sitting there, like, talking through the credits, like, trying to figure out, like, oh, my God, so what does this mean about this? Like, how does this tie in? Like, we're just, like, chatting about it. And everyone else in the theater, like, I turn around for a minute, and I just see everyone else, like what? I don't understand it. And, like, then, like, the people behind us, immediately behind us, are like, what are you guys talking about? I was like, have you guys seen Unbreakable? And they're like, oh, no, I mean, I've heard of it, I guess. Like, it's one of his movies.
Yeah.
And we're like, yeah, well, this is a tie-in to that.
Yeah. The fact that they chose to tie it into Unbreakable made me, if there was any movie it was going to tie into, it made me incredibly happy that it was Unbreakable.
Well, did you know that this character, Kevin Kolb, was actually written as a part of the first Unbreakable script?
Oh, really?
Yeah, so apparently in an M. Night Shyamalan interview, they talked about, or they asked him about how it ties into Unbreakable.
Mm-hmm.
And M. Night Shyamalan, if I remember correctly, was saying that it's not only like they tie in, but they're inherently linked together because they are the same story. That Kevin Kolb was originally part of Unbreakable, but he cut Kevin Kolb out. He cut the character out because it didn't fit in the movie.
Which makes sense. That movie would have been a lot worse if it didn't have it. But, I mean, because Unbreakable, I mean, we can have a discussion about Unbreakable another time. I have to rewatch it. It's been a while. But to have a movie that's 17 years old.
Yeah, and get a tie-in.
Yeah. But it's crazy to me that that didn't get near as much play, like marketing-wise or whatever, especially because it came out after The Sixth Sense. It was supposed to be part of that original trilogy, the Belief trilogy.
Right. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so that's why Bruce Willis is in Sixth Sense and Unbreakable. He was supposed to be Mel Gibson's character in Signs, but there was a schedule conflict, and that's why they got Mel Gibson.
Was it supposed to be all three were the same character?
No.
Okay.
It was all three supposed to be Bruce Willis.
Oh, wow. Speaking of Bruce Willis, can I pitch you my movie idea?
All right.
Okay.
Let's do it.
Okay. It's called Ghost in the Closet.
Not Ghost in the Shell?
No, Ghost in the Closet. And it's about Bruce Willis buys this house. And he goes and he's like living there for a brief period of time. He buys it from like this dude. And then like there's all these weird like happenstance around the house. Like there's a ghost living in the house. And then one day he discovers that the guy who sold in the house had murdered his wife in the closet. And so the ghost is tied to the closet. She has unfinished business, obviously, which is why she's a ghost. But Bruce Willis, like, in trying to solve this crime and, like, find proof that the husband killed her, falls in love with the ghost. And so Bruce Willis falls in love with this murdered wife. That's the whole movie. Except there's a twist ending where it's actually...
Bruce Willis is dead the whole
time. Bruce Willis has been dead the whole time, and it's actually a sequel to Sixth Sense.
Is that actually your twist?
Yeah, that's actually my twist. It's a Sixth Sense tie-in. Yeah, no, absolutely. And the movie is called Ghost in a Closet, not because there's about a ghost in a closet. It's because Bruce Willis is in the closet about being a ghost.
Mom, Dad, I gotta come out of the closet right now. I'm a ghost.
I've been a ghost this whole time. So yeah, the movie. I've pitched a Split-esque sequel to Sixth Sense.
I'm sorry, that's terrible.
Yeah, no, it is.
It's absolutely terrible.
But would you watch that over watching The Shack?
The Shack?
Have you not seen the trailer for The Shack?
No.
Let's stop this right now so you can see the trailer for Shack.
Okay, hold on. I'll pull it up. We can watch it in real time.
Okay. It's a movie, I believe it's produced by Tim McGraw.
The
country singer. It's produced by, what's his wife's name? She's the country singer as
Leanne
well?
Leanne Rimes? No, someone else.
Maybe it's not his wife, but it's another country singer. So it's produced, I think maybe written and... I don't want to say it's directed because who the hell would let two country singers direct a goddamn movie? but The Shack looks like the worst movie I've seen ever. And I love bad movies.
I know, we both do.
Yeah, I think everyone should have a healthy relationship to bad movies. I think they're so important for culture in general. But I think...
Go watch Samurai Cop.
Yes, go watch Samurai Cop.
The Room.
I'm watching Gods of Egypt later today.
Oh, God.
I can't wait to see it. I mean, go see Pacific Rim. That's one of the worst movies ever made.
You take that back.
Pacific Rim is hot garbage.
Pacific Rim is amazing.
The only good sequence in that movie is the sex scene.
There's no sex scene.
Not a literal sex scene, but there's a metaphorical sex scene where they fight with sticks, and she shows her domination over the phallic symbol.
All right, here we go.
So, yeah, this is The Shack. The Shackfish trailer.
All right, hold on.
So, yeah, establishing shots. Okay.
Let me react.
Okay.
Is that Sam Worthington?
Sure.
Missy!
So, yeah, Missy's dead.
Mm. Sorry. Trying to get the mic closer, dude. Based on the New York Times bestseller. So it's based on a book.
Uh-huh.
Well, that was Tim McGraw right there.
Yeah, okay. So he's freaking out. This is where his daughter was killed by some murderer. I don't want to lose you, too.
For from the producers of Life of Pi and The Blind Side.
Yeah, hallmarks of quality.
It's all I got. It's all I got, man.
Okay, hold on.
Are you confused yet?
That's his daughter?
That's what I thought. I don't think so. I think that's God. I think it's about a man's literal relationship with God. But hold on. Watch, you'll see.
My... So yeah, Sam Worthington.
Yeah!
Okay.
Oh, wait, hold on. Where's the shot? Oh, there's... I think we missed it, or it was in another trailer, but there's one sequence where Octavia Spencer says... Or Tim McGraw says to Octavia Spencer... Not Tim McGraw. Sam Worthington says to Octavia Spencer...
You want to try that one more time?
Where were you when I needed you most?
And Octavia Spencer's... was it in there?
Yeah.
I missed it completely.
That's when I was like, oh, is she his daughter?
I think she was... I think that's...
Supposed to be God.
Supposed to be God. I'm not entirely sure... But who knows? Who knows? It's hold on. So yeah, it's not written or directed by either of them, but it's produced by Tim McGraw and something else. Somebody else?
Let me see.
Yeah, let's
say. Faith Hill is his.
Faith Hill. Oh, excellent. So here's the question is
did the soundtrack.
Would you rather watch they produced it.
They probably did. Yep, nope, written. Oh no, that's the song.
Uh-huh.
Whatever. We'll look it up.
Would you rather see The Shack or would you rather see Ghost in the Closet?
Probably The Shack.
You're an asshole.
Why? Your movie sounded like hot garbage.
Yeah, that's
not
the
even
point.
Not even hot garbage. That's funny, but just like,
no, I think you'd pay the price of admission for the twist because it's M. Night Shyamalan. No. I'd get him to produce and direct. I would just write.
Yeah, he'd just completely rewrite the whole thing.
No. I think he'd buy it. I think he'd go in for it.
I don't think so.
Let's do it, man. M. Night, call me. Let's make Ghost in a Closet a thing.
Ghost in the Closet sounds like one of the worst things. I'm sorry, that just sounds absolutely terrible.
That's just your opinion, dude.
All right, so my question. Uh-huh. So that's your thing about. So you got your own M. Night Shyamalan thing.
Yeah. So let's talk about sequels.
Yeah, that's my thing. So
sequel conversation.
Having to set up sequels. This isn't going to be very long. I hate it. I personally hate it. I understand with all the Marvel movies and stuff. At least for the Marvel movies, it's like, hey, we wrapped it in a bow, and you have to stay after the credits, which kind of part of the movie, but it's not part of the movie.
So
like that one, I understand because it's superheroes, and there's always going to be a new adventure.
Right. I think you have to explain a little bit more in depth. Like, what do you mean by setting up a sequel? Do you mean you hate when a movie has to extend itself so that it can
possibly
lead into a second movie?
Yes.
Okay, so where we're being telegraphed, hey, there's going to be another movie. To be continued, ?
Like the end of, like when I first saw Bruce Willis show up at the end of Split, I was like, oh, that's awesome. You know, because as soon as he said Mr. Glass, I was like, oh, like I freaked out in the theater. I was like, oh my God, that's awesome. 10 minutes later, I was like, they didn't need to do that. Like they really didn't. Like I get it. But to me, that felt more like an executive being like, how can we tie this in and create our own universe?
But we know that it's not. Like
You don't know that.
Yeah, we know that it's M. Night Shyamalan made this movie to...
Because it was supposed to be a part of that. Yes, but...
And that there is another Unbreakable coming out. Like we know that he wanted to do this. This was the plan.
Okay. I didn't know any of that. I'm just coming from watching the movie.
And walking out of the theater, you can feel that way, absolutely.
Yeah, I just felt like it was unnecessary. But if it came back later, like the trailer is like, oh, now these two are together, I'd be like, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But I want it to stand on its own merits first.
Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I have to agree, like, setting up the sequel in the sense of, like, a movie's, like, conclusion, logical conclusion has already occurred.
Yeah.
And now we get the end with the question mark at the end, or we get the to be continued dot dot dot, or yeah. the, you know, Spider-Man will appear in, you know, the Avengers. Like all those things, I have to agree, because like if we go back to a famous movie from this podcast, Don't Breathe. We talked about Don't Breathe.
Yeah.
Do you remember Don't Breathe?
Yeah.
Watching it? Do you remember the last sequence where she's at the airport and she's leaving with her sister?
And he's still alive.
Yeah, and he's still alive. Like,
to me, that wasn't setting up a sequel.
But then what was that?
I don't know. To me, that didn't feel like a sequel thing. Because I don't think he's going to come out and
get her. I mean, I think it makes no sense as a sequel. If that movie becomes a sequel, or if there becomes a sequel for that movie, I will...
Not go see
it. I'll see it opening weekend. I will just have a freak out. Where I'd be like, how do you make a scene? Is the blind man going to chase her down?
Yeah, see, that's the thing. Because it's logically like, okay, to me, it's more like she just has to live with the consequences of what she did. She doesn't get a scout. To me, what it was you're never fully...
You're never going to escape
the
reality.
Never fully absolved from the consequences of your past actions. You have to live and deal with that. It's a matter of where you go from there.
Okay, yeah, I agree.
That's how I took that.
I like it. To me, it was just... This is a setup for a sequel.
To me, it wasn't a setup for a sequel.
Okay.
Bruce Willis being there at the end, set up for a sequel. The end of my biggest gripe over this past year, and I've talked about it before, was the end of Stranger Things. Where the kid goes into the bathroom and coughs up the slug.
Yeah.
I wanted that so bad to end at that dinner table scene. Everything's fine.
Mm-hmm. I think it should have ended with them playing... Because there's this moment when they're playing D&D again.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, D&D is fantastic. Go pick it up, play. But there's a scene where they're playing D&D again, and the Demogorgon shows up, and the character makes a decisive fireball, or protection, whatever he says.
Yeah.
And they roll, and it's like, all right, and you go...
Critical hit, you got it. Yeah.
You go to the princess, and you turn in the thing, and you've won. And then they have that very meta question of like, but what happens to the princess? And like, what happened to the lonely knight? And like, what happened? And they're asking like, what about all these loose ends that were in this show that we, you know, exist in the world of?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, so yeah, you got a little meta there, but you're bringing up very clearly, like, look at all these loose ends. And so, I thought, yeah, I think ending it there would be perfect of like, yeah, there are loose ends, but like,
that doesn't matter. As a big fan of Lost, I'm okay with loose ends. The visible shaking right now.
Lost had three good seasons, and then a writer strike happened, and it never recovered. And anyone who disagrees with me is an idiot.
I think the final season was good, though.
And then the final season was hot garbage.
I think you're hot garbage.
I think they spent so long trying to make us think it wasn't purgatory that after we already knew that it was purgatory, that having a last season where it's just telegraphing to us that it's in purgatory was like, it was too spoon-fed. Just end it.
I get you.
Just end it.
I think that like final shot though of them all meeting in the church was pretty powerful though. Different topic. Doesn't matter. Okay, so yeah, I mean,
to setting up sequels. Yeah,
to me, like Stranger Things did not need a sequel. To me, I thought Stranger Things was going to be almost like an anthology type thing where every season's new.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking
that would have been way better. Like each season is just one thing and then we go on to a new story. It doesn't matter. Yeah, there's obviously going to be loose ends all the time because it's really hard to tie up everything. But that was a solid like B+ show. Yeah, and
remember the last great TV show that tried to do that?
What? Tie everything up?
No, try to do a second season that's not connected to the first one.
Which one?
True Detective. Remember
I didn't watch.
Yeah, True Detective season one is phenomenal, and then it ends, and they're like, we're going to do another season of True Detective with different actors, different characters, different story.
They just did a bad story. Here's the thing. I think no matter what, season two would have been bad, because they blew their whole wad in the first thing. But that's also because they're setting it up to be a certain type of show.
Right.
Right? But so True Detective, it's a crime drama. You know, it's a crime drama.
Right.
There's only so much you can do. Stranger Things with a title like that can literally be anything. You can go into outer space.
Just do a loose sci-fi show.
Yeah, you can do a new sci-fi show. You can do a horror type thing.
I agree.
You can do anything with a title like Stranger Things.
But I also think Stranger Things had such an... I don't think if they had done...
See, my problem is that it wasn't like those episodes were coming out one at a time and they're like, oh, this is getting really popular. Let's shoot the finale with this thing.
Uh-huh.
They had that in mind before it even came to air.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think what you're not realizing is so much money.
No,
so much money.
No, I know that.
I mean, have you heard about what happened to D&D this year?
No.
Okay, so since Stranger Things...
Oh, D&D has just skyrocketed?
It's blown up.
I can imagine. No,
stores couldn't keep players' handbooks in stock for a while.
I totally get that. I understand the marketing behind it. I just think, that's the thing. That's where I'm saying, what executive came in and said, put Bruce Willis at the end of this.
Well, no, okay, so I get what you're saying. Yeah, there does seem to be like this bad taste in our mouths about how things end leading into a sequel, because we just know it's just some freaking asshole sitting around like, hey, we're making another one because this is going to make a ton of money. So
yeah,
because
I mean, imagine if you read like a fantastic book. Like, imagine you're reading...
Yeah, the last page it tells us, but it's not over.
Yeah,
it's
but like, then well, in the last page... You. Yeah, but then the last like two pages is like... But like Stephen King... Like, imagine you were reading it, and at the end, Pennywise just shows up again for no apparent reason.
Yeah, then it's like, oh, fuck you, Stephen King. I have to go buy another book and read... I just read the book.
Exactly.
It was perfect.
Like, if it's supposed to be a series like Harry Potter, I get it.
Right.
You know, it's like... But those even wrap up neatly, and it's like, here's a new adventure in a new year.
Well, yeah, I think specifically, Harry Potter does a really freaking good job of making 8 movies that all are good, except for the last two, which is just wait.
I didn't even see 6, but like the last one, or whatever the very last
one. Part
1
and part 2. Stop breaking up movies.
I only saw part 2, and that whole thing was just I was kind of drunk when I saw it, honestly. But that whole thing to me was just like a 2-hour fight montage.
Yeah, and the same thing happened when they did Twilight. Don't ask why I watched all those movies. They did the same thing when we watched the Battle of the Five Armies, Desolation of Smaug set up. It's like, stop breaking up these movies.
Exactly. No,
The Hobbit is one children's book.
I know,
and they made it into
three.
Three?
Yeah, they did three. The first two are the book, and then the third is all based off like the after notes about like what happened
during the Battle of the Five Armies when Bilbo was unconscious.
Yeah,
because Bilbo was unconscious for all of that. If listeners don't remember reading The Hobbit, by the time that he gets to the mountain, the Lonely Mountain, and like the five armies show up to have a battle, he gets knocked out in the first 10 seconds and wakes up after everything's done.
Yeah.
Like that. Fuck you, Guillermo del Toro. Fuck you.
Guillermo del Toro didn't do those.
Exactly. He should have, but he didn't because he wanted to go make Pacific Rim.
They just took him off of it.
No, he walked.
Did he walk?
Yeah.
Oh,
after like multiple years of pre-production, he walked like a month before they started shooting and left Peter Jackson with nothing.
Well, Peter Jackson could have made a better movie.
Yeah, with years of pre-production than Guillermo del Toro had.
Yeah, I guess.
But instead, Guillermo del Toro was like, you know what? I'm going to go make a movie about monsters fighting robots.
Well, because I'm sure the studio was coming in and being like, nope, this is how we're going to do it. Because Peter Jackson has a hand in writing all those scripts, though, so he probably
already knew
we're going to break it up and do all this stuff. And Guillermo was probably like, I don't want to do that. I want to make it into these things.
It should have been one movie.
Yeah.
And it should have been helmed by one person for the entirety of it, and as opposed to being dropped on Peter Jackson, but none of that matters.
Whatever.
We got Pacific Rim from it, and now we're getting a sequel starring everyone's favorite fucking clone trooper. Not clone trooper, stormtrooper.
Yeah.
John freaking Boyega. What?
John Boyega. I'm gonna be there opening day.
So am I. I'm seeing an opening day, but fuck everyone in the making of that movie. First off, how do you even lead into a sequel for Pacific Rim? Speaking of leading into sequels, Pacific Rim does not.
No, it doesn't. And that's why it's great. It's just like, yo, we killed these things. We closed the dimension.
But so now we're getting a sequel, and John Boyega's a star now because
Charlie Hunnam's back though.
Right, but it's also starring John Boyega.
Who is I believe he's
from
supposed
Star
to be
Wars.
No, I'm saying in the movie.
Right, but he's from Star Wars.
Yeah, I know.
So we have to throw him into this. What does he elevate? Is he a good actor? No.
Alright. Well,
he's perfectly adequate.
Alright, so there you have it. Our ideas on Split and how to make a good movie if you're M. Night Shyamalan and Ding Dong.
How to meta game your audience, I think, is what that was.
And honestly, I'm glad this is what he's doing, because if studios are just like, hey, this is your budget, and this is the movies you're going to make. We're going to have a lot of great movies.
Maybe.
That's the thing.
We're going to have a lot of Pacific Rim 2s, though.
I'm completely okay with this. I don't know what your problem is.
I'm mentioning Pacific Rim again. That way you can't cut all that part out where we talk about Pacific Rim.
No, I was going to cut out like half of it.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I was going to find a stopping point and just cut it.
Okay.
Well, all right. I guess we might as well do the outro now instead of me cutting and doing the outro.
Yeah. So let's script the outro as we're doing it. So what is the outro usually?
Normally it's me. Oh, well, thanks for listening. I hope you guys enjoyed it. And here's how you can follow me, email us, whatever. And so, I guess it's just, all right, well, thanks everyone for listening this week. I hope you guys enjoyed our conversation, and hopefully this goes well with a new co-host.
Yeah, I think it went fantastic, Matt. Thank you for asking me.
Yeah, I hope people don't tune out.
I hope people tune extra in. I hope that you balance it so that all my voice is coming out of the right headphone and all your voice is coming out of the left headphone, and they just listen to the right headphone.
That sounds like an absolutely terrible idea.
It would be terrible. Don't do that. Also, if you're listening to this, don't just listen to what I'm saying, although that's all I really care about. I'm kidding.
I make great excellent points.
You do. I think that was
it was
an excellent discussion. I think we should have a call to action. I think we should tell listeners, hey, listener,
Split.
Well, yeah. Person sitting in their car driving to work and or like sitting on the couch listening to us instead of watching TV, because that might be interesting. You know, try that sometime. But maybe you should go see Split. I think we both think you should, especially if you like Unbreakable.
And I actually want to go see it again personally.
Call
the
Matt.
The more I think about it,
Matt will buy
I
you
really
a ticket,
like
and
no, I
Matt will also buy you drinks and popcorn.
This will not happen.
You invite him to go see it.
False.
He told me that in confidence that he would do that no matter what.
This is all lies, but also, I can't believe we're starting off the podcast this way. You nothing but lies.
But also, listener in your car or on your couch, go ahead and write in. Go ahead and shoot us a message. Send us maybe, if you know our personal phone number, send us a text message or tweet us at whatever Matt's tweet is.
Don't text us because I want these things to be on the, but that's just
okay,
my opinion accounts. So
don't text us then. Just
go on Facebook and follow us at www.facebook.com/btjmopod. We are also on Twitter at btjmopod.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can write into us via email at butthat'sjustmyopinionpod@gmail.com. There's no apostrophe.
Yeah, so send that over. Go ahead and shoot us an email, shoot us a message, give us a like on Facebook, and tell us what you guys want to hear us talk about. If you want to hear, how does Matt feel about M&Ms? If that's what you want to hear about, then
peanut.
I think you should read in. I think he's an idiot for liking peanut M&Ms. Almond M&Ms are the superior M&M. So yeah, if you guys want to hear,
I'm the superior person compared to you.
We could do an entire episode on the difference between M&Ms, the difference between tacos and burritos, the difference between Rick and Morty and Winnie the Pooh, and like which one's better. I think we can probably.
Well, there's no
any
Rick
topic.
And Morty ride yet, so
exactly. I mean, like that could spawn a whole discussion. If you want to hear,
I do love Rick and Morty.
If you want to hear our silky smooth, sexy voices talk about something,
ooh, yeah.
Maybe you're Matt's mother and you just want to hear about how Matt's day is gone.
So write in, Mom. You can continue to call me. You don't have to go to the email.
No. Go ahead. Go to the Facebook. Give us a like and then leave us a message that says, "Hey, do an episode about how Matt's day has been." Or do an episode about how Matt and Carly are. You know, just like whatever you guys want to hear.
Yeah, so now that it is two co-hosts, we will take... Before it was like, instead of having people ask us what they want us to talk about or anything like that, we can do that now.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you want to hear Matt's take on the appropriate temperature to drink coffee at.
And maybe you want to hear nothing from David.
Because everything I say is asinine. Or maybe you want to hear about, like, how does Matt feel about, Fall Out Boy current day?
We've already discussed this.
We have discussed this, but I mean...
That's episode one.
There are so
That's
many
episode
things that,
one.
That is episode one. There are things that, like, I want to pick your brain about, and I think listeners do as well. Like, what's Matt's favorite bourbon? And why is it his favorite bourbon? Can he articulate that?
You know what? I have not had enough bourbon to really... I need to have more bourbon.
We should do a bourbon drinking episode.
I'm actually down. We'll do some research and
only if it's requested though. I don't know if I want to go buy a bunch of bourbon and do an episode that no one wants to listen to, but if people are like, "Hey, you know what? Do a bourbon episode where you guys just get drunk and talk about what bourbon is good or what goes good with
That's
bourbon."
That's going to have to be on a weekend. Can't do it before work.
Yeah, you know, tell us ahead and we'll plan a Saturday out where we just get super wasted in the middle of the day.
All right. Thanks everyone for listening. Follow us everywhere and David, since this is your first week co-hosting, I'll let you pick the song for this week. So what do you want the listeners to go out on?
Let's close out with Fire Coming Out of the Monkey's Head by the Gorillaz off of Demon Days.
Great. Well, I'm sure I've heard this song before, but not really too familiar, but I hope everyone enjoys it, and we'll see you guys next week. And remember, whether you agree or disagree with us, that's just our opinion.
Once upon a time, at the foot of a great mountain, there was a town where the people known as Happy Folk lived. Their very existence a mystery to the rest of the world, obscured as it was by great clowns. Here they played out their peaceful lives, innocent of the litany of excess and violence that was growing in the world below. To live in harmony with the spirit of the mountain called Monkey was enough. Then one day, strange folk arrived in the town. They came in camouflage, hidden behind dark glasses, but no one noticed them. They only saw shadows. You see, without the truth of the eyes, the happy folk were blind.
Falling out of aeroplanes and hiding out in holes, waiting for the sunset to come, people going home. Jump out from behind them and shoot them in the head. Now everybody dancing, the dance of the dead, the dance of the dead, the dance of the dead.
In time, strange folk found their way into the higher reaches of the mountain, and it was there that they found the caves of unimaginable sincerity and beauty. By chance, they stumbled upon the place where all good souls come to rest. The strange folk, they coveted the jewels in these caves above all things, and soon they began to mine the mountain, its rich scene fueling the chaos of their own world. Meanwhile, down in the town, the happy folks slept restlessly, their dreams invaded by shadowy figures digging away at their souls. Every day, people would wake and stare at the mountain. Why was it bringing darkness into their lives? And as the strange folk climbed deeper and deeper into the mountain, holes began to appear, bringing with them a cold and bitter wind that chilled the very soul of the monkey. For the first time, the happy folk felt fearful, for they knew that soon the monkey would stir from its deep sleep. Then there came a sound, distant first, that grew into gastrophony, so immense that it could be heard far away in space. There were no screams. There was no time. The mountain called Monkey had spoken. There was only fire. And then, nothing.
Oh, a little town in the USA, time has come to see, there's nothing you believe.